Hello and Happy New Year. Timothy Revel here, New Scientist's Deputy US Editor. Today we've got something a little bit different for you. It's a reissue of a podcast we ran a couple of years ago, but on a completely separate feed, so many of you have not heard it before. It's called Escape Pod, and the idea of the podcast was just to discuss interesting, delightful stuff from the world of science. We did that because it was the middle of the pandemic and we needed a bit of an escape, but there's still plenty of life stressors to escape from today too. So we think you'll enjoy hearing this now for either the first time or once more. This episode is all gathered under the theme of understanding. We've got the self-awareness of dolphins and whales, the impossible abilities of gymnasts and ballerinas, and a game with more moves than there are atoms in the universe. We hope you enjoy the show.
Well, I'm going to kick us off with a story about a whale, because, you know, who doesn't love dolphins and whales? Let's have a soundtrack, please, magical Ollie producer. Our starting point is the Farallon Islands. They're off the coast of Northern California. A few years ago, there was an incident there where a whale got tangled up in some crab lines used by some of the suppliers to the seafood industry of San Francisco. And a 15-metre female humpback whale got tangled up in these crab lines, and she couldn't surface properly because the weight of the crab pots was making it hard for her to get her blowhole over the water. So, you know, she'd been struggling and the ropes were cutting into the...
Oh, gosh, Ruin, I thought this was supposed to be a skate podcast. Sounds traumatic.
Yeah, come on.
Oh, no, okay, it's getting there. I'm just building up. So some scuba divers, some rescue divers went in to get her, and they spent 5 hours cutting the ropes. And one of the divers was called James Mosquito, and he reported afterwards what happened. He says, "When I was cutting the line going through the mouth, the whale's eye was there winking at me, watching me." And he said, "It was an epic moment of my life." And the team said that there was this weird vibration coming from the whale as she watched them cutting her free. And then when she was freed, this is the thing, she didn't just swim away. She swam around in circles, and then she approached each member of the rescue team and gently nuzzled them with her head. Oh. Yeah. Oh. Mosquito said, "It felt to me like it was thanking us, knowing it was free and that we'd helped it." So, you know, I've just never forgotten that account.
Oh, it sounds beautiful.
Yeah, I've just got this vivid image of a diver working by the giant eye of a whale and the eye watching him as he's doing it. It turns out humpbacks are sometimes more friendly than other species of whales. Either of you had any sort of weird encounters like that with not necessarily a marine animal, but, an ape or anything like that?
The thing I remember is, do you remember we had this story of, I think it was maybe a year or two ago, about how horses can remember whether you were smiling or frowning the last time that you saw them? Uh-huh. And I just love this so much. And whenever I see a horse now, I always remember to smile, because you know they're going to remember next time you see them. Yeah. What you were doing when you see them.
Yeah, always smile at a horse.
Yeah.
And there's another story that stuck in my head. It's because it's difficult to work with, as a scientist, it's difficult to work with whales and dolphins on anything really, you know, tricky like consciousness, because, you know, they're stuck in the water. But there was this experiment where scientists gave dolphins a puzzle to solve and recorded the audio of what was happening. And it turns out that when the dolphins worked together to solve the puzzle, they made more whistles and clicks and more vocalizations than they did when they're just on their own.
So they were chatting about it.
Yeah, they were effectively chatting and perhaps, you know, exploring ways to solve the puzzle. And look, I get there's so much amazing stuff about dolphins and whales, but there's another thing. There's a population of dolphins in Brazil that work with people to catch fish. So the fisher people stand waist deep in the water, but the water's really muddy, and the people they can't see into it. But because dolphins have sonar, they can see into the water. So when the fish come along, the dolphins herd the fish together and then signal to the people. The dolphins slap the water with their tail or else sort of suddenly dive down. And that's the signal to cast the net. And these dolphins have a different kind of dialect, different whistles to those that don't do it. So there's some kind of dialect among the dolphins that work with these people.
Yeah, the dolphins give each other some sorts of names, don't they?
Yeah, they have signature whistles that are distinct to particular dolphins. So they might go...
And, I didn't know you spoke dolphin.
Well, that's a, yeah, that was dolphin. And, so what some researchers can do is you can play the signature whistle through a hydrophone and then the dolphins whistle back. So you might do that. And then the dolphin, and that might be saying, hey, is Tim over there? And then the same whistle comes back from Tim, and which basically means, yeah, I'm over here. And then they might add whistles after that, which might add historical context to that name. So it might be, yeah, it's Tim, who I'm the one who caught that fantastic octopus the other day, remember?
Oh, wow. Reputation names.
yeah, exactly. It might be reputation status, social status. You know, all of this is just to say, you know, there's a scale of consciousness and a spectrum of abilities of theory of mind and self-awareness, and there's not this sharp divide between humans and other animals. Now, Anna, let's bring us back to dry land. What's your means of escape this week?
Now, I thought we could talk about ballet and gymnastics. I confess, actually, I have more than a passing interest in ballet. It's probably one of the few obsessions that compete with my interest in physics and science. Well, actually, they don't compete at all. People, when they see ballet dancers doing all these impossible-looking things with their bodies, people like to say they're defying physics, but they're absolutely not. You know, and if, when you really think about it and you look at it, it's more like a really exquisite demonstration of some of the really fundamental basic principles of physics and Newtonian mechanics and momentum conservation and so on. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, nothing defies the laws of physics. But I guess in headline writing, it's a kind of law to say gravity-defying basketball player or ballerina. Because they do seem to hang in the air, don't they?
Yes, they do. And there's little tricks, like the way you open your legs a little bit more as you're coming down, so it looks like you're not actually coming down and things like that.
So tell us about the balancing and the training and how it works when a ballerina will start to twirl, or that's not the technical word for it, is it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, all that teetering around on the tiptoes, I guess, is what looks most obviously balletic to a lot of people. And obviously, if you just launch yourself onto a pair of pointe shoes without any training, it would hurt like hell, because you'd be, no offence intended, but it would be like a dead weight just flopping around all over the place. And you have all these torques and awkward pressure points and stuff. So all the training gets all the muscles tuned so that they can align and control your centre of mass along the line of strongest support to your big toe. And so then you've got all your twitch muscles to hold you in balance, so it looks like you're just floating. And then it gets easier when you start turning, obviously.
Right, so how is that?
Well, they call it the gyroscopic effect. It's the same thing that kicks in when you're on a bicycle. It's a lot easier to balance on a bicycle when it's moving than when it's standing still. And that, yeah, so it comes from the angular momentum of the wheels turning, or your ballet dancer turning. And the angular momentum is greater the faster you're turning. And so if you want to then topple the axis of that turn, you then have to create a torque that's strong enough to overcome that angular momentum. Whereas when they're not turning, there's no angular momentum to overcome. So it's quite easy to just flick a ballet dancer off a pointe shoe. Yeah. And then, of course, when you're in the air, you've got more to deal with, because when you're on the ground doing your turns, you can push off the ground and you can give yourself that extra angular momentum. You see them doing their fretty turns in the Sugar Plum Fairy or Black Swan solos and whipping the leg round and pushing off with that releve each time. And then you can keep getting more angular momentum and try and keep all that in control. When you're in the air, you've got nothing to push against. It's really all in the launch.
So the fouette turns, is that's when they kick the leg out and that just keeps them going round, does it? Okay.
Yes, fouette is whipping. So all that whipping into a frenzy has to be impeccably controlled. And of course, if you're in the air, you haven't got the ground there to push against to correct yourself if something's a little bit awry. So if you're doing turns in the air, then you really need to get yourself in order and you take off.
That leads us nicely onto Simone Biles. I watched her legendary triple double before we had this chat, and it's still incredible.
That does defy physics.
Oh. So go on. Well, if people can't remember it, can you just explain first what is the triple double?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, even if you've seen it, especially if you haven't seen it in slow motion, you might still wonder what on earth was going on there. There's an awful lot going on. It's this extraordinary gymnastic leap where she turns, you need to turn twice through an axis going through the hips, like a somersault, or for the less athletic of us, a roly-poly.
Yeah.
And then three times around the axis going from head to toe, so the axis you turn in a pirouette. So it's just a double backflip with triple pirouette at the same time.
Oh, just that.
Just.
Yeah, so Simone Biles pulled this off, the first woman to pull it off in a competition in the US Championships in August 2019.
And what was special about her that she managed to be the first woman to be able to do that?
I think it was a lot of determination and a lot of practice. I think it is quite character telling to pull off something like that. But it's obvious physics, isn't it? And when you come down to the training, obviously you get the muscles again. It's really, again, conservation of momentum. So you see her when she starts, she's gearing up for it. There's a massive, powerful run up. So that's giving her a load of momentum that she can then send airborne and give her the airtime to fit in all these twists and turns. And if you watch it in slow motion, that launch, she looks like a, I think especially with all the blurring of the slow-mo frames, it looks like a jet of water. Every molecule of her body is perfectly aligned in a perfect projectile trajectory.
Mm.
There's not, you know, she's not wasting a joule. It's very, very efficient launch into the air.
That's what the coach said. Well done, you didn't waste a joule there when she landed. But how does she start the spinning once she's in the air, though?
Well, the spinning actually starts in the launch. So when she's taking off into a sort of dive. So there is already angular momentum going around her hips, but she's in this long stretched, you know, full of force. And the angular momentum is not just proportional to the speed of the spins, but also the radius, the distance from her extremity to the axis she's spinning around. So she then tucks. And that makes that radius shorter. So you have to have the angular momentum conserved. So the spins speed up to compensate. So she can fit in more turns around that axis around her hips. And then you see her arm whipping, a bit like you see the leg whipping around with those ballerinas doing their footy turns. And that sets off in motion the turns around the head-to-toe axis. And this is, she's basically just got to then hold it all out because there's not a lot you can do in the air to correct yourself when it's going wrong. You just want to hold your knees tight and your feet tight. And I think a lot of muscle memory just makes it all that magic come together. Yeah. Yeah. Couldn't resist.
It just also all happens so quickly, right? It feels like when you see it in real time, it's like she kicks off and then before you've really realized what happens, she lands again. And all of that has happened. It's just amazing.
It is. It's extraordinary. Yeah. Just the overcoming the impulse to just protect your head when you're spinning around upside down, because you've got to hold yourself all neatly in aerodynamic and, you know, with your central mass movement control. And then, of course, the landing. Otherwise, if she doesn't get that right, it might be the last jump she ever does. So at that point, you don't want to squeeze your knees together and everything. You need your knees and feet under your hips, your knees going straight over your toes, so it's all aligned, and you want a really, really deep plié to absorb all of that impact. And she actually does a little bit of a hop back again on that. Well, forgive that hop, but it gives you a little bit more of a absorption of that massive, massive momentum, yeah.
But even then with the hop back, it's just so, it feels like such a small reaction to what has just been an explosion of energy. And then she smiles to the audience or holds her hand.
Like it's she's just, done nothing.
Yeah, like she's done that. You can't sit, you know, if I could even imagine jumping that high, let alone doing all of the rest of it, I feel like I would absolutely be puffing. I would be sweating all over. And she just a little wave and then carries on and does, you know, 15 more amazing moves.
Yeah. Yeah, it's extraordinary. But yeah, that's how it's done. I wouldn't try it at home necessarily. No. Tim, what's your escapism this week?
Go, which is a board game.
Can you play Go, actually, Tim? Have you ever played it?
I have tried. It's one of those games that it seems really simple, but then a little bit like chess, you can sort of very quickly get a bit confused about what you're meant to be doing. So I've played against a computer, but though I've played probably dozens of games, I've never actually won one.
And so why is it in your escape pod this week?
Okay, what I really like about Go is that it's a beautiful example of how something incredibly simple can become absurdly complicated very quickly. Go is played on a 19 by 19 board, just like a grid, and you place down stones according to a few very simple rules, and the aim of the game is to capture territory. But when you work out the number of possible ways that a game of Go can occur, there are more moves than there are atoms in the universe. Yeah, which just really blows my mind. And in fact, it's not even close. Like, you think it's one of those, oh, maybe it's just a few more moves. The number of possible ways that a game can occur is 10 to the power of 170, which is a 1 followed by 170 zeros.
Yeah, it's a daft number, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just, you can't comprehend silly. That number. Yeah. But the number of atoms in the universe is just 10 to the 80. So it's just not even close. That just really, really blows my mind. But so one of the reasons that I'm particularly interested in Go, and that many people are, is because of its link to artificial intelligence research. And the thing about Go, because it has so many moves, is there's no way that a computer can just solve it. There's no way for it to a computer just work out all of the the best thing to do in any given situation, because you couldn't store that information, because you'd need all the atoms in the universe many, many, many times over.
Has that comforted you at all, the idea that it's not something that you can crunch solve mathematically?
Yeah, I think so. I think, like, when you're a bit confused about the universe and all of the, you know, the what makes life complicated, and then you look at something as simple as Go is extraordinarily complicated, I find some comfort in that even the simple things are so complicated. There's no way I can possibly worry about all of the big complicated stuff, because that's even more complicated.
Just have a game of Go.
Always smile at a horse, and even the simple things are complicated. These are the things I'm taking so far. Yeah, carry on, Tim.
Okay, so one of the things that has got people particularly focused on Go recently is the fact that now the world's best Go player is an artificial intelligence called AlphaGo, which was developed by DeepMind, which is a very famous London-based technology firm. And what makes it interesting is, because you can't just solve Go, because you can't just work out the best thing to do in any given situation, AlphaGo had to learn to play instead by learning from hundreds of thousands of games through trial and error. And at the end of all of this trial and error, even though it couldn't possibly know the best move in a situation, because that information just can't be hard-coded into it, it could make a good guess. And some people think of this as it developing a sort of intuition. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah, so it made there was a famous move, 37, it made, that this is the one that people think was an intuitive, creative work of genius by AlphaGo, right?
Yeah, so like this sort of intuition it developed was, even though it learned from a lot of human games, actually was not like human play at all. So in its famous matchup against Lee Sedol, who was a Go grandmaster, AlphaGo played a 5-match series against Lee Sedol, and it won the first match, and it sort of won the first match by just not really making any mistakes, you know, in a very sort of machine-like way. But in the second game, this move 37 was a moment where it placed a stone whereby if a grandmaster did it, everyone would think the grandmaster had lost his mind or her mind, because it went against, you know, thousands of years worth of studying Go that you should not put a stone on this particular square at this particular time. But then when they went back and looked at what point AlphaGo had won, it was the turning point. And so all of the pundits now consider it to be one of the most beautiful and creative bits of gameplay in Go, done by anyone, and yet it came from a machine.
And saddled by humans' training and stuff, experiences.
Yeah. What's interesting is that in the first iteration of AlphaGo, it learned from human games, and then it also did lots of games against itself through trial and error. But then in later versions of AlphaGo, it decided to completely dispense with any human intuition, because it seemed that actually that wasn't maybe the best thing. And it started right from the beginning just playing against itself. And that is the version of AlphaGo we have at the moment. And that is way better than any of the preceding ones. So it's sort of, on the one hand, it's really exciting, but it's also a bit embarrassing that thousands of years worth of grandmaster play by humans that went into AlphaGo actually turned out to make it a worse Go player than if it just learnt by itself, machine on machine.
You seem to be granting AIs this creative ability. I think most people will. So do you think eventually they're going to have, we'll get this artificial general intelligence, a human level intelligence in AIs?
My feeling is that it's a long way off yet. Yeah. So yeah. It's really...
Yeah. Still got a job.
But I think what we will see soon, and we're already starting to see, is this sort of AI that can solve or provide some sort of solution for very, very complicated problems. And like Go is an example of that. It's just not a problem that people, that, you know, that gives you any practical examples. But there are so many situations where you have fairly simple rules that lead to something that's really complicated. Just when you look at, you know, at the building blocks of life, fundamental physics, the way atoms interact, or even the way weather occurs, all of that starts from very simple rules that suddenly become incredibly complicated with, you know, billions and billions and billions of possible outcomes. And so if your AI can develop some sort of intuition involving some sort of creativity to provide solutions that humans couldn't have thought of themselves, I think that would be really exciting. I think that's a long way off a machine that is artificial general intelligence that is, that can surpass humans on every task. But on these sorts of tasks, this could just, it could completely change our understanding of a lot of parts of the universe at the moment. I think that would be amazing.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks, Anna. That's all for this week. Thanks for joining us on the first mission of the Escape Pod. We'll be back next week. Do let us know what sort of things you'd like us to feature, and we'll do our best to oblige. We're on Twitter at New Scientist Pod. And just before you go, there's a special offer. You can get a subscription to New Scientist for 12 weeks for half price at the moment. Go to newscientist.com/escape12 to get your special discount bargain. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.